There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello, welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. This is our daily podcast, bringing together the very best bits of today's show from Monday, November the 11th. Netflix is cracking down on password sharing. We're going to hear from the boss of Starzplay about that practice coming to our shores here in Dubai.
This is people sharing their passwords for streaming services such as HBO, Netflix, whatever it happens to be, with other people, and effectively having a couple of people who shouldn't be using an account. Researchers reckon that around 14%, 1/4 of Netflix users report that they are using a password that comes from outside their household. I reckon it's a lot higher than 14%.
Yeah, I mean, you'd almost be, I don't know, dobbing yourself in, wouldn't you, if you put your hand up for that?
Well, look,
effectively,
people are getting in touch with us. Just a bit of background. This has come about because the industry itself has formed the special working group to clamp down on password sharing, probably not unrelated to the fact that there's another giant that's going to enter their industry tomorrow, Disney Plus. This is the Netflix co-founder and in fact the first CEO of Netflix, Mark Randolph, speaking to Yahoo Finance about what they're doing.
There's abuse, and that's not fair. But the whole time you want to make it easy for people to be flexible. You know, we travel. We have family who's living in different places.
Sure.
And so the problem, and again, it's at the very beginning it was like this, is that you don't want to put in place barriers that impede people who are trying to do the right thing. So I don't think we're talking about people coming into your apartment and putting you up against the wall and saying, show us your credentials. I mean, we're looking at broad cases of fraud, broad cases of flagrant abuse, you know, 50 different instances going on all over the world in the same account.
Talking about broad cases of abuse there, but is the average family with availability to stream on 5 devices, they've got 4 in the house, they give one to their next door neighbour who's struggling a little bit and hasn't got the money, is that flagrant abuse, or is that just a sort of a bit of bleed that they would accept? I think that's the question.
No, I don't think that's just what's going on though, because there are several ways that you can hack the system. We're not here in the Business Breakfast
to tell you how to get
around
it.
To give you a guidebook, but anyone who has, and again, we're saying Netflix, but we're using that as a kind of a catch-all term for the streaming services and also for a lot of new services like Masterclass that have come on.
But I mean, I think Netflix is a good example in the sense that they've spent so much money on content and they've got everything on there that a lot of it's unique, which is why people want it, which is why there is a demand for a subscription, whether you pay for it or not.
Yeah, and you can set up with most of these streaming services a number of different profiles. So there's one way that you could mess with it. You've also got a number of devices, but as everybody knows, you can, I say everybody, there are ways to play with this depending on what time people are watching things. If you're in different time zones, you can go well beyond the numbers that Netflix is, you know, giving you sort of fair use, I guess we can say, fair use of their network. A number of people getting in touch with us saying, here's one, I know a few college kids who all chip in for subscription charges and share a Netflix password. Someone calling himself Bobby De Niro getting in touch to say, my brother's got a UK Netflix account with 4 devices. You know, it's a no-brainer. Someone else saying, look, why don't they just tag the account to the device? And as we've heard there, like a specific device, as we have heard there from the one of the Netflix founders, they want flexibility. They know that people travel. You might want to use your own Netflix account in a hotel room, for example, with a smart TV.
That example of the students, though, is an interesting one, isn't it? If you had 5 students, 5 different devices, they all chip in. They wouldn't have taken it individually, probably because it's expensive, but they can do it as a group. I mean, right or wrong? I mean, this is what would Netflix think about that?
And see, this is the thing. And I mean, and you don't even, it's not even about devices, because once you've got time zones coming into it, or even just people who have different habits, different work habits, whatever it happens to be. Number of people, here's one, we share Netflix between immediate family members in Spain and the UAE. I think this person says, I think it's legitimate with the same family unit. So we are just doing that. Here is Maz Sheikh. He is the guy behind Starzplay, which is a Netflix competitor. He reckons that it isn't actually the biggest problem that should concern service providers.
So while this has been happening for
for over 10 years. Now they're paying specific attention to it because their growth has slowed down in these markets. But I think they can take countermeasures, but they have to be extremely careful doing that because it can also upset customers, you know, who are simply sharing the password with their kids or with their families. You know, technically, we all limit to two simultaneous streams. So, you know, there might be 5 or 6 people who have access to the service, but only 2 of them can watch it simultaneously. So to me, there are other bigger problems with piracy. For example, people who do not subscribe to your service altogether and who are using other illegal means of downloading the service.
Now, Maz also said to us that he reckons that the problem of the password piracy, the password sharing, is much bigger in the US and Europe than it is in this region. There are a number of ways that people in the industry think that they could clamp down on this, because the question is, how do you stop it from happening? How do you stop me giving Malcolm my password and he sits down and you know, watches a movie in the afternoon when he gets home from work, and I watch it in the evening and no one's any the wiser? One of the things they're thinking of is changing passwords more and more. One of the things that's being considered apparently is texting codes to your phone that you'd need to enter in order to keep watching.
Ooh, like OTPs.
That would be annoying, wouldn't
it? That would be very, very annoying. So would it, changing password every day or whatever?
Oh, completely. I mean, to get into my television to change a password is a mission in itself. And in fact, I've given up one subscription because the password just stopped working and it was such a faff to go in and sort it all out that I just didn't bother. Thumbprints is another one that they are thinking. I mean, I've got a laptop that takes a fingerprint as more and more of those devices become available.
So what, you'd actually register the 5 fingerprints you wanted to use it and nobody else could use it?
Could do.
How do they know that the fingerprint isn't your next door neighbour's anyway? So,
well, I mean, and this is just it. And there has been a very big blind eye turned to a very, very long time. But with more competition coming in, it seems that there is going to be more and more of a crackdown.
I suppose one of the underneath all this, what Netflix is seeing is demand for its services. And they've thought now, if they're spending so much money on producing all these TV programs, now if they can sort of claw back even 3, 4, 5% of that sort of bleed, if you like, the 14% people using it and not paying for it, that would be an easy pot of revenue to tap into. And I'm sure there are people out there thinking, yeah, maybe it's time I got my own subscription, rather than using Joe Blogs from round the corner.
People, relationships break up and people still use, I mean, this is a thing. People still use their ex's password. People use the passwords of, you know, roommates that you've shared with. It's been seen as part of the business, actually, for a very long time. And in fact, HBO, its former CEO, once called the practice of password sharing a terrific marketing vehicle for the next generation of viewers. They were like, we're getting people hooked. Yeah, and then obviously, yeah, you know, you move on. The people you've lived with move on. You realize it's time to get your own password, whatever it happens to be. And they've acquired another customer. But, I mean, that's a long game.
It's going to be virtually impossible to change if people think that they're not doing anything wrong, if people think that they're entitled.
Well, and this is where you get into that grey area of illegality where something technically is against the rules, but like a lot of downloading, people are just so used to it.
It hurt anybody, they
say. As a practice, yeah, buying fake goods, whatever it happens to be, people don't see a victim, so they don't necessarily see it as stealing.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
7Rooms is a hospitality technology company that records our data when we book and eat at restaurants and uses that data to improve our future experiences. In the studio, we have Joel Montagnol, CEO and co-founder of 7Rooms. Joel, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
How and what do you collect?
So we are helping restaurants and hotel restaurants understand your preferences. So if you prefer a certain type of sparkling or still water, as well as what you're purchasing in the restaurant, as well as special occasion information such as birthdays. And the whole goal is to help the operator make you feel at home.
But surely they'll know that when I order sparkling or still water.
So that's right. And what we're trying to help transform is having a system to capture and manage that information versus historically has been in people's heads. And I think everyone's had the experience where you go to a restaurant that you're a regular at. The service is really great if the people are there that know you. when you go back to that restaurant, if those people are not there, it's different. And so we want to help eliminate the need to have the information stored in people's heads and really transform it to a system so anyone can provide you with that service.
Are we actually creatures of habit so much that we are going to order the same thing again the next time we go? Is that helpful or is it just annoying?
I think you see a mix. Everyone is a little bit different. You have creatures of habit, and then you have people that want to try something new every single time. And helping the team understand what type of guest is in the restaurant is super helpful. I mean, if you look at what people get in grocery stores, just as an example, if you look at people's shopping carts, you'll see just a variety of things that people like. So just imagine how you translate that to a restaurant.
So the data collected on Brandy, myself, Richard, for instance, would be resident where, on the hotel database or on your database?
In our database, and then we mesh that together with the hotel database. So for instance, we would tell the hotel restaurant that you're also a hotel guest when you walk up to the host stand.
Look, I get the familiarity. I mean, it's feeling like you're local, isn't it? I mean, it's that whole cheers thing, going somewhere mm-hmm. where everyone knows your name. Yeah. You sit down, they say, Mr. Taylor, bottle of sparkling water. And you think, oh, yeah. How do you do that, though, without being creepy?
So it's a really good question. It's one of the things that we think about all the time. You know, one of the goals for the company is how do you use technology to actually enhance the personal touch and the humanness? And how do you use technology so that it's not creepy? One of the things that's really interesting in being in hospitality is this is one of the few industries where we think consumers want that type of personalization. And in fact, they'd be willing to share more information if it leads to a better experience. So what we say all the time is the hospitality industry really invented personalization. And this is an industry that is really great at using information in a subtle way. And so we think about how do you just enable that more type of personal experience and leave it up to the operators to use it in a way that is meaningful to the guest.
How do we make sure, though, that our data isn't used as a way that's meaningful to third parties who then want to send Malcolm a load of spam selling him six packs of sparkling water? Do you promise not to share any of that data, pass it on?
Absolutely. We protect it. We are fully compliant with all the regulations, so GDPR. Given the type of footprint of customers we work with, you know, American Express has been one of our customers, public financial companies. We've had to be very protective of the data. And ultimately, we are consumers ourselves. So we want to make sure that we're getting a great experience and protecting that. So we do protect the data and make sure that it's not used for purposes that don't make a meaningful experience for the guests.
What sort of peek into your client list can you give us, both here and, say, in New York? What sort of institutions are using you?
Sure. So we're fortunate to be partnered with operators all throughout the globe. Here locally, Jumeirah Group has been one of our longstanding customers. It's been an amazing partnership with them. Mandarin Oriental Worldwide is one of our clients as well. And then partners all throughout the world. So whether you're talking about New York, Hong Kong, LA, London.
One of your studies in the US found that 31% of respondents think hotels with great restaurants are more memorable than those without. I mean, nice, but less than a third think a restaurant makes a hotel memorable. Does this speak of a move away, do you think, from a one-stop solution and all singing, all dancing hotels? If only 30% would go there to a hotel because of a restaurant, that's 70-something percent that wouldn't or don't really care that much. Do you think maybe younger hotel girls want a decently priced roof over their head but are happy to wander off and find food elsewhere?
I think it's actually we're starting to see the trend move the other way. So we're all living in the experiential economy, and you're finding that consumers are willing to spend more money on experiences than on products, and in particular on restaurant experiences. So one of the key stats is we're seeing hotel food and beverage revenue grow 5.5% year over year since the past 6 years. So I think you're only going to see that number start to go up, and hotels certainly are paying a much larger focus on their food and beverage offering. In particular, it helps them compete against things like Airbnb.
But they are, as Mark's alluding to there, I mean, budgets are tight. Are you seeing that reflected in your business?
We haven't seen any type of impact in that regard. Hotel business is generally up across the world. And what hotels are looking for is how can they continue growing their revenue. And room revenue has increased pretty significantly the past 10 years. So food and beverage revenue is one of the areas where they're really investing in.
Is there any data to sort of suggest how much more successful restaurants are inside hotels or outside? I don't even know where the volumes would be greater. Well, what's the sort of data comparing hotels, restaurants, and non-hotel restaurants?
We don't have So if we dug into the data, we could see, I'm sure, what the type of success is. We could look at the restaurants in hotels versus outside of hotels. We do see certain brands, for instance, the Public Hotel in New York, where they led with food and beverage first as at the hotel level, and the restaurants have been very successful comparatively to other restaurants that have opened up nearby.
Because the reason I ask that, because you'd think automatically that the hotel restaurant has a captive audience, but quite often you go into hotel restaurants, there's nobody there, and it's soulless and it's lifeless. You go around the corner, there's a restaurant doing pretty well.
Yeah, one of the things to note is, you know, it takes a little bit of time to jumpstart the restaurant, and the distinct advantage that hotel restaurants have is their cost structure is slightly different than others. So, for instance, their rent might be less, they might get subsidies, and typically you're talking about sometimes a celebrity chef. So they have the benefit of being able to play with their concept and evolve it more than a local restaurant would.
Joel, thanks for your time. Joel Montagnol, CEO and co-founder of Seven Rooms. We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
I'm very pleased to have Natasha Thomas in the studio. What's all this about gold bars on the tram?
Well, today is the Dubai Tram's 5th anniversary. Can you believe it? It's been 5 years since the Dubai Tram was set up. And commuters now stand a chance to win gold bars and other prizes as part of the RTA's celebrations. So if you travel on the tram from today, any day, you could win gold bars.
What, someone's just going to randomly wander up and give me a hunk of gold?
If you have a tram ticket, then you are automatically in the draw to win a gold bar.
Yeah, I'm guessing you can't get on without a ticket, though, can you?
No, you can't. Yeah. Have any of you been on the tram?
Yeah, Brandy's
yeah,
a
totally.
Regular.
Do you know what? When it first opened, yeah. I made a bit of an effort to take it down to... Because on a busy weekend or a busy evening, if you're going down to the beach... you can park underneath, but it is busy, busy with your cars. Everyone's going slow, showing off and all the rest of it. It's actually much nicer to get down there on public transport.
Yeah. Now, I'll be honest, you know, unless it's in your route, you don't really think of taking the Dubai tram.
Yeah, it's the same with the metro, isn't it? You do. You take it when you need it. And
I think it's good. The Dubai metro, it's a longer route, right? So there's several more stations, covers a more wider area of Dubai. But with Dubai tram, it's such a smaller area that you'd never really think about it. So myself, I've never been on the tram, and I was going through the stations it covers, and it goes to Jumeirah Beach Residence, which I should have known, but I didn't really pay attention to. And when you think about it, on weekends when it gets so busy driving down to the marina, that's probably a better way.
Public transport is your friend.
Exactly. So yeah, I was doing some research on some unusual facts about the tram. So apparently, it's the first tram in the world to have platform screen doors. So these are those doors which prevent passengers from falling onto the tracks. This is the first tram network in the world which actually adopted that system.
That makes it a metro station lookalike, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Yes.
Interesting. Tell us about the Dubai Mall. A lot of people will have seen pictures and videos that I know have been being shared around social networks of Dubai Mall in the rain.
Yes, so these...
the rain in Dubai Mall.
The rain in Dubai Mall. So these pictures and videos, they went viral yesterday after the rains. But you could see there was water in what looked like the ground floor of the mall yesterday. But it's business as usual now. Officials have said that everything's under control. So the Dubai Media Office later yesterday, they tweeted saying that the only limited areas of the mall had been affected by the water. They've confirmed that shops remained open throughout the incidents, and staff were working towards resolving the issue. And Dubai Mall's developer, Imar, they sent a statement to us at ARN News, and they again said, you know, please be assured that the safety of mall visitors, staff and tenants remains our utmost priority. And in terms of the rains, it looks like there will be more unsettled weather conditions over the next few days. Not so much in Dubai, but further up in the Northern Emirates.
Do we see a spike in sales of kayaks and Wellington boots?
Not yet. We're not there yet.
I love a bit of wet weather gear.
I love Wellington boots. You don't really get them here, do you?
Or gum boots, as we call them where I come from.
Yes, we used to call them gum boots as well. We had black, ugly ones. We never had those pretty ones you see nowadays.
Coming from Wellington, you call them gum boots.
We call them gum boots.
You call them Wellington boots.
Well, actually, in New Zealand, you'd have a pair of red bands, is what you would actually
what
have.
What is?
Red bands.
Red bands.
Yeah, they're black rubber boots with a red band around the top, red bands.
Ah, interesting. Ours like Ray Bans, plain but red black. Bands. Plain black, and we used to love wearing them to school, like during the rains. My brother and I would wear these massive boots.
I'm going to come to work tomorrow fully decked out in the wet weathers.
There's quite a lot of stigma attached to wellies, isn't there? If you've got sort of like a fold-down furry bit at the top, or if they're green or
red. Oh, no, you've got your... Well, if you're British, you've got your hunters, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, Glastonbury's
you know, that's your posh wellies.
What's the stigma?
Hey, not stigma. You can be you can have posh wellies. The green ones are always thought of as being a
market.
Oh, yes, and you know, if you look at the ones that wander Glastonbury, go on and look, search for wellies Glastonbury. You'll see what I mean.
Okay.
Fun fact: the cinema complex in my hometown. The word complex is a bit grand, by the way. I think it's got like one screen, maybe two. Has banned people from wearing gumboots to the movies.
Why?
Do you need to?
Because people were wearing gumboots, bare feet and pyjamas to the movies and they have enforced a bit of a dress code. The dress code being you have to be, like, dressed.
How does it matter?
To be honest with you, out of all three of those things, the one I would have kept with the gumboots and banned the bare feet and the pyjamas.
Oh, I don't know. I think a movie in your pyjamas.
Nothing wrong with that.
Comfy.
Yes.
Hot water bottle, fluffy slippers, you're away. Right. Have you been speaking to Serena? Because Serena and I have been having a big chat about this Apple Card and the furore over the algorithms powering it. Do you know what? We're calling it the Apple Card because it's known as the Apple Card. But to be fair, responsibility-wise, it's Apple and Goldman Sachs. That's the bank behind this credit card. There was a bloke called David Heinemeier Hansen who was tweeting about the Apple Card yesterday. He said... Well, I can't actually say what he said because not all of it's safe for radio, but I'm going to paraphrase. He said, the Apple Card is a sexist program. My wife and I file joint tax returns. We live in a community property state. What he's basically saying is, you know, they have shared assets, so they're both worth the same amount of money. We've been married for a long time, yet Apple's black box algorithm thinks I deserve 20 times the credit limit that she does. Anyway, so he tweeted that. Everyone started retweeting it, including, by the way, Apple's co-founder Steve Wozniak, who jumped on board and said basically the same thing had happened to him. He said that he and his wife have no separate bank or credit card accounts or any separate assets. So again, they're both worth the same amount. And that he got offered 10 times more credit than she did with the new Apple Card. The new Apple Card is this very beautiful, obviously, because made by Apple, card that's both physical and on your phone. Now there's an investigation by the New York Department of Financial Services for discrimination because they say everyone has to be treated equally in the financial services sector because it should go on your credit score.
Yeah.
And the guy who sent off the original tweet, who tweeted the original tweet, said that his wife's actually got a better credit score than he does. And yet he was offered more on the credit card. How does that work? And this is interesting because there's such a big debate at the moment about bias in algorithms, particularly the machine learning algorithms. We know that if you're in front of an interview panel or whatever, that human beings have bias, conscious or unconscious. There's been so many studies done on that, it's not funny. But are we effectively inventing AI? Are we inventing programs that have bias? These sort of black box algorithms, which take care of themselves and even sort of the inventors can't really say how they're working once they're underway. And this would seem so. I mean, funnily enough, once this tweet went viral, Goldman Sachs bumped up the credit limit, which the guy who sent the original tweet is like, well, it just kind of proves that it's nonsensical because they didn't even ask for any more documentation. They just decided that all of a sudden it was okay. And he's trying to make a point about machine learning algorithms rather than the companies themselves. But there is now an investigation.
I mean, you would think that technology won't discriminate, but, you know, when you explain it like that, it makes me wonder that whether you can program your biases into these algorithms. And
accidentally.
That's really what's
happening.
Well,
I was going to say, I think that's the whole point, isn't it, of algorithms, to discriminate, to make a difference based on previous history. That's how, you know, of what we look at on the internet and everything else.
Exactly. But this is a different kind of discrimination. It's obviously not looking at your creditworthiness. Yeah. It's not looking at your scores. It's discriminating you because of your gender.
It's plainly wrong. It's nice to see these cases where it is so...
But it's a interesting that technology is doing that and not a human being. But that's because the human being who set it up has programmed his biases into that technology.
A lot of this is unconscious. Yeah. And of course, this is all a brave new world with a lot of these algorithms as well. So let's see what that inquiry finds out. Natasha Thomas, it's good to speak to you.
Same here.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
The latest State of the Global Islamic Economy report. We are getting an exclusive sneak peek of its headlines now with Abdullah Mohammed Alawar, who is the CEO of the Dubai Islamic Economy Development Centre. It's lovely to see you again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's look at the headline numbers in this report. How has the last year been for the Islamic economy?
I think overall it's been great. I think as the report highlights, it's very clear that there is a year-on-year growth in terms of the value of these sectors. More importantly, I think the indication that consumers out there around the globe are spending more on products that are compliant with the Sharia is a key indicator that there is that growth. As the report highlights, in the halal industry and the lifestyle sectors, the expenditure was 2.2 trillion US dollars by 2018, and it's expected to grow to 3.2 trillion US dollars by 2024. In terms of Islamic finance assets, the values were 2.5 trillion US dollars at the end of 2018, and the expectation is that it will reach close to 3.5 trillion US dollars by 2024. So both across the spectrum, I would say, across the Islamic economy spectrum, there is growth, which is good to see.
I mean, those are really, really big and impressive numbers. Compared to what we're seeing in other sectors and compared to what we've seen in previous growth, how would you put it into words what we're actually seeing?
I believe it's a sign that businesses out there are considering these sectors to be of significant importance to their within their business model. We have seen throughout the years a lot of the international, I would say, companies and global companies embarking upon offering products that are compliant with the Sharia in key markets. The reason for that is that it makes sense for them from a business perspective. Equally, I think the consumer is becoming more and more aware, regardless of the background of their faith and religion. The consumer is feeling better about consuming these types of products, knowing that they are more sustainable, that they are also more healthier in a way, to consume. So it's working on both sides.
$3.5 trillion by 2024 is a big amount of money in anyone's book. What is included in your definition of the Islamic economy?
Well, the sectors span across, I would say, and they include Islamic finance.
Including the Sukuk market, that includes the total Sukuk market.
Absolutely, the Islamic finance universe, I would say, which is capital markets, the banking, of course, sector, the Islamic insurance or takafal, sector, etc. In the halal sphere, that also is all-encompassing, I would say, not only limited to food and beverage, but
travel, pharmaceutical products.
Products, cosmetics, etc. But across the lifestyle sectors, you have, for example, the family-friendly tourism sector, the media and recreation sector, the design sector, that is all adhering towards those same principles. So our definition of the Islamic economy is quite comprehensive. And if I may add, one way to look at it is I wouldn't say that this is like a replacement, to the economic ecosystem. It's more of a complementary, I would say, addition to the existing economic, ecosystem that exists.
About 5 or 6 years ago, we saw a spurt of conventional companies, so companies that didn't necessarily have links to the Muslim world, investigating Islamic structures for fundraising to widen the pool of investors that they could get in.
Absolutely.
Is that still happening?
It is happening. It's happening even more, in my opinion. We have seen a lot of examples where foreign jurisdictions have actually launched or issued Islamic bonds as a means to raise financing throughout their projects, whether these are infrastructure projects or else, or others. We have seen recently huge markets, jurisdictions, China, for example, with their Silk One Belt, One Road strategy. We often say that within this One Belt, One Road strategy and physically throughout that Silk Road, there are numerous opportunities where Islamic finance can, lend itself towards developing those infrastructure projects. And I think these jurisdictions understand the importance of that. That's why we have seen a lot of the foreign jurisdictions actually issuing these bonds, listing them here, for example, in Nasdaq Dubai, to raise that financing for those projects. So that's another indicator that this product or Islamic finance, so to speak, is meant for everyone, not only for, Muslim jurisdictions.
In Western, traditional Western markets at the moment, ethical investment is very popular. Veganism, vegetarianism is growing. Do you think you see a sort of gradual merging of the overall sort of Islamic halal market and the sort of ethical market, if you like?
In my opinion, I think it's a natural fit. There are a lot of global movements that promote the adoption of so-called ethical, if you will, and green, for example, financing, etc. And when we look at the underlying principles of the Sharia-compliant products, or let's say the Islamic finance products, we realize that it's, 99%, similar in terms of value. So in my opinion, that's a natural link. Equally, I think Islamic economy sectors are naturally equipped towards achieving, for example, the SDGs, the UN SDGs, again, because of those underlying principles, of those products.
So where is there still room for growth? I mean, in your report, the UAE's top 5 out of 7 sectors. What are the 2 that we haven't? Where have we still got a room to grow?
I think there is a lot more to do, in my opinion, in the Islamic finance sector. The way the report, I believe, measures Islamic finance is in terms of asset value. So the more, I believe, institutions are out there, the more products that are being launched, the more, I would say, the opportunity is there, for us to grow in. Across the other sectors, such as halal food, I believe the UAE has ranked quite well. And that's mainly because of the a mixture of reasons, but mainly because of the infrastructure, the strong infrastructure that Dubai has, and the logistics, corridor that it has established. But also in the what I would call the emerging sectors, for example, fashion, modest fashion, design, media and recreation. These are where I think a lot of growth can be achieved, over the next 2 to 3 years.
Abdullah Mohammed Alua, the CEO of Dubai Islamic Economy Development Sector, in with that new report. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We're back tomorrow at 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.